From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. In Ukraine, Russia says nearly 700 more Ukrainian fighters have surrendered at the steel plant outside Mariupol. They're being taken into Russian-controlled territory, and their fate remains unclear. Meanwhile, Sweden and Finland formally requested to join NATO today, further isolating Russia and something Putin had tried to deter by launching the war against Ukraine. Let's get the latest on all this from Sudarshan Raghavan. He's correspondent at large for our editorial partners at The Washington Post. He's reporting from eastern Ukraine, from Dnipro in eastern Ukraine. Sudarshan, welcome.
Great to be with you again, Anthony.
Let's start with the situation in Mariupol. We heard yesterday how Ukrainian forces, after holding the steelworks factory for weeks, finally surrendered to Russian forces. What's the latest that you're hearing today about the situation there?
Yes. So the Russian Defense Ministry indicated they had roughly about 700 Ukrainian fighters had surrendered in the past 24 hours. It's unclear really what's going to happen to them. Mm. There's speculation that the Russians may use them or even try them for war crimes, while Ukrainians say they're hoping to do some sort of a prisoner swap. What could complicate matters is that the Ukrainians currently are actually putting on trial in Kyiv a Russian soldier who had shot a civilian. And so this might convince the Russians to do something similar with the soldiers that they have in their custody now.
I see. Complicated situation. So their fate remains unclear. Let me ask you a little bit more about the situation beyond Mariupol. Ukrainians managed to repel Russian forces from Kharkiv, and we heard yesterday that life has begun to return to some kind of normal there. How big a setback is that for the Russians?
Well, it is a setback, of course. I mean, they had initially tried to take over the capital, Kyiv, in the initial days of the invasion, and that failed. And now the second largest city in Ukraine, a city that they've been bombarding for the past weeks, and they have now have been pushed back towards the Russian border. At the same time, you know, Russian forces are still close to certain areas around Kharkiv, and there is the possibility of them pushing in again. It's not a completely done deal, but definitely it is a setback. And more importantly, it's a psychological win for the Ukrainians. I mean, they're going to be carrying this confidence, this morale, a boost into other areas, particularly in the areas where I'm at now in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas region, where the Russians are trying to take territory where I am.
I see. Well, let's talk about that because we're hearing that Dnipro was just hit by two missile strikes this morning. Tell us about what's going on there, how the city's been dealing with this latest attack.
Well, Dnipro is quite far from the front line. In fact, these missile strikes was a bit of a surprise. It's been really relatively quiet here for days now, certainly since I've arrived. We're not 100% sure where they hit. Some speculated it might have been a bridge, but it's unclear. But what's more significant is that the war right now is happening about 30 to 40 miles away from Dnipro. In fact, I was at one of these front lines just yesterday, and it was a seesawing conflict. You know, the Russians would push forward a bit, the Ukrainians would tactically retreat, and then they would reinforce and then prevent the Russians from moving forward, so that this front line has kind of been static. It's a much different war happening here than what happened in Kyiv, which I covered several weeks ago. Less urban warfare, much more artillery. The terrain is different. It's a lot of small villages and towns and open fields. That's where that stands.
Right. Meanwhile, Sudarshan, Finland and Sweden have now formally applied to become members of NATO. That's something they avoided throughout the Cold War. Russia has threatened retaliation as more of its neighbors turn to the West. I'm curious to know how Ukrainians, in the midst of a war with Russia, are reacting to this news. Are they reacting to this news? What are you hearing?
Well, definitely, you know, they see this positive because, you know, this is to them and to most people, they would look at this as a more deepening isolation of Russia. You now have two countries that for years, decades, sought neutrality. who are now so troubled by what the Russians are doing to Ukraine, so concerned that the Russians are a threat now along their own borders, that they've decided to reach out and join NATO. So yeah, for the Ukrainians, it's another sign of support for the war for them.
Well, that's Sudarshan Raghavan. He's a correspondent at large for our editorial partners at The Washington Post. He's reporting from Dnipro in eastern Ukraine. Sudarshan, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Well, we want to take a closer look now at a Supreme Court decision this week on political spending. The court's conservative majority sided with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz in a case over how candidates can pay back borrowed money from their campaigns. It's the court's latest move loosening campaign finance restrictions. NYU law professor Richard Pildes joins us now. Professor, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So this all started back in 2018 when Senator Ted Cruz loaned his campaign $260,000 the day before the election. Why was that a problem, and how did that violate the 2002 McCain-Feingold Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act?
The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act permitted candidates, if they loaned money to their campaigns, to pay those loans off with contributions that had been raised before the election. And they could also raise money after the election to pay off loans, but only up to $250,000 in loans. Ted Cruz wanted to challenge this law. He thought it was unconstitutional. And so he loaned himself more than $250,000 at the very end of the campaign, precisely to challenge this provision.
So why was this practice banned in the first place? What was the law intending to prevent?
So both before and after the election, individuals can contribute up to $2,900 to a candidate's campaign per election. The concern about those contributions coming in after the election, beyond this $250,000 limit, was that once you know a candidate has won, you're contributing money to a winning candidate. That's much more valuable to do than, you know, risking the money in advance the candidate may lose. But on top of that, the view was candidates are going to be particularly grateful to people who help them pay off personal loans they've made to their campaigns. And therefore, the risk was that the candidate would be too beholden to those donors.
I see. So Senator Cruz says that this is a victory for the First Amendment and for freedom of speech in the political process. But in her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan said, quote, "It doesn't take a political genius to see the heightened risk of corruption, the danger of I'll make you richer and you'll make me richer arrangements between donors and office holders," end quote. So, Professor, what's the potential impact of this ruling?
I don't think this was considered a major campaign finance decision one way or the other. It will have a minor effect. Candidates will loan themselves larger amounts of money than they were willing to loan before this. You know, even if they loan themselves $1 million, they can pay that $1 million off if money can be raised after the election in these $2,900 chunks.
Right. But, so that was Chief Justice Roberts' opinion. That's what he said in the majority opinion, that there's still this cap, a $2,900 cap on contributions, and that will continue.
That's correct. And one of the big underlying debates is how much the government has to actually prove that there's real corruption going on. Justice Kagan says in dissent, look, it's obvious the candidates are going to be beholden to donors who give them $2,900 to pay off their personal loans after the election. And in fact, we see in the states candidates who do this then look to be giving benefits to those donors. Chief Justice Roberts says, well, there's correlation there, but there's not real proof that the benefits were given because this money was used to pay off these loans. And this is just a tension that runs through a lot of these cases. How much of a burden does the government have to bear to actually prove concretely that there's real corruption going on? Of course, it's very difficult to prove that.
You've said, Professor, that this isn't considered to be a major decision, but the court has already struck down parts of this law. What does this week's decision tell you about the future of this law and where the court stands on campaign finance?
Well, we've known for many years now that the Roberts Court, is highly skeptical of many of the campaign finance laws that have come before it. I don't think we're surprised by this decision. It's of a par of a piece with a lot of the other decisions. And the court has now held unconstitutional a variety of provisions in the McCain-Feingold law. There's one major provision that's still left, but most of it has been held unconstitutional at this point. We have a system in which vast amounts of money can pour into elections. There's very minimal constraint on that. And we see that. We see that in these primary elections, vast amounts of money being spent. We see it in general elections. And there's certainly no indication the Roberts Court is backing off from its view that the First Amendment provides strong protections for campaign spending during the election process.
That's NYU Law Professor Richard Pildes. Professor, thanks for the perspective.
Glad to talk to you.
Tom Daley is Britain's most decorated diver. He's been to four Olympics, the first in 2008 when he was only 14. In Tokyo last year, he teamed up with Maddie Lee to win the gold medal in the 10-meter synchronized diving event. Here's their gold medal-winning final dive.
Oh, it's a cracking dive! Oh, my goodness! They've nailed it, Chris!
But as Tom Daley writes in his memoir, diving has not only been a source of great joy, but at times, great anxiety. Love and fatherhood have helped him gain some much-needed perspective on life. Tom Daley's book is Coming Up for Air. It published in the United States this week, and Tom Daley joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start at the London Olympics in 2012. You had that famous redive where you were allowed to do a very rare redo because you were distracted by all the flash photography in the crowd. Tell me why you chose this story as your starting point in the book.
I feel like this particular starting moment was such a pivotal moment in my diving career for so many different reasons. One being because when I was 9 years old, I drew a picture of myself in a handstand with the Olympic rings and it said London 2012 underneath it. So for my whole life, I dreamed of going to that competition and performing there. And I had always envisaged how it was going to go and winning a medal and all that kind of stuff. And that moment was threatened. And it was that moment of being in a home crowd and thinking it was going to go one way and it went another. And it was a really stressful situation. But also it was the moment that, you know, I finally got my first Olympic medal. And after that, I didn't know where to go. I didn't have any direction or any purpose because I'd worked so hard to that one moment. And then I really didn't think about what was going to happen next. Yeah. What was I going to do with my life? And, you know, suffered then from post-Olympic blues and then started suffering from all kinds of anxiety related to that moment that happened in that diving competition. So it was like really like a new start for me of what was going to be happening for the rest of, well, from my life up to date.
So after that extraordinary moment, London 2012, you collapsed emotionally. And you write about this very openly in the book. You say, after the exhilaration of my London 2012 experience came the rush of the Olympic blues, the lowest of the lows that seemed to stick far longer than the transitory triumph of my medal achievement. Can you describe what happened, Tom?
Everything just happened so quickly. And, you know, I was only 18. And then at that same time, I was coming to terms with my sexuality and then really being worried about what might happen if the public were to find out. And then, you know, that was when I then met my now husband. So there was lots of things that were going on that were causing so much stress and anxiety that I felt like I couldn't really concentrate properly on my diving. So it was a really, really tough year for me, actually, until I met Lance. And it was that that kind of inspired me to get back into diving and see things from a slightly different perspective.
Lance, the love of your life, you met him during a chance meeting in Los Angeles in 2013.
Yes.
You decided to come out on your own terms online.
Yeah, I came out on YouTube in a video, mainly because that way I can say exactly what I want to say, nothing more, nothing less. Nobody can ask me follow-up questions, and nobody is able to twist my words.
Yeah, well, here it is.
I met someone, and they make me feel so happy, so safe, and everything just feels great. And Well, that someone is a guy.
That video got over 13 million views, so it sounds as though you hit a nerve somewhere there for sure.
At the time, like, I didn't think about anybody actually watching it. I just wanted to do it to, like, just get it off my chest. And it was this really liberating moment where I finally felt like the shackles were gone and I could actually just be me and not have to worry about what other people thought.
Let's go back a little bit, because throughout your career, you have struggled with mental health issues, and you write very openly about this in your book. Your struggle with perfectionism, compulsive thoughts, you write about the nightmares. You describe how at practice, if you completed a dive well, you'd feel great for a few minutes, and then you'd feel terror and panic because you realized you'd need to do it again and soon.
Yeah, those particular feelings surrounded around my twisting dive, the one that happened in the London 2012 Games. And, you know, I suffered from a similar thing to what Simone Biles suffered with last year, which, you know, she called the twisties. But it's like a very, very common thing in sports like diving and gymnastics, where you can get so terrified about a particular skill that every time you go up there, it's just an achievement to get it off the diving board one time. And, you know, it really did consume me in so many ways, to the point where I had to figure out a way of being able to do something different and being able to think outside of the box. And I remember one time my coach came back at the beginning of a season and she showed me a YouTube video of somebody doing a trick on a Cirque du Soleil show on a Russian swing. She showed me the dive and was like, okay, I think we can turn this circus trick into an Olympic dive. And that was how I was able to overcome and, you know, think slightly differently about how I was going to do this twisting dive.
Mm. What does go through your mind? I've always wondered, standing on that dive plank, however many stories up from the water, looking down, especially when you have all these thoughts going through your minds, all these doubts, you know?
Yeah, it is terrifying, honestly. And you kind of learn to get used to that fear. But that adrenaline and that fear is like what keeps you sharp and keeps you focused. And as soon as you are no longer scared and become a little bit complacent, that's when mistakes happen. But, you know, standing on that diving board, you have to really think about the process of what you're doing and not think so much about how you want to land and the outcome of the dive. You have to just be really, really thinking about the process of how to do that, the arm swing, the jump, how, like, you are going to straighten your legs out of the diving board, where your arm position is going to be. And you're constantly making all of these micro decisions and adjustments all the way through. I mean, it's only 1.6 seconds from the platform to the water. And then we hit the water at 35 miles an hour. So there's really not much room for error.
Well, I was struck in the book how your parents were endlessly supportive throughout your career. They never pushed you into any of this, but they loved you through some very difficult periods. And I especially love the descriptions of your dad coming to every competition, sitting in the stands, holding the Union Jack flag, right? He was your biggest supporter, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my parents have always been so incredibly supportive of me, and in particular my dad. And I remember, like, one time I went for my first senior nationals when I was just coming up for 10 years old. And I was so nervous about making a fool of myself and embarrassing myself with the performance I was going to do. And the night before the competition, I said to my dad about how nervous I was. And he asked me, how many divers are going to be in the competition? And I said, 18. And my dad said to me, well, even if you come last and you come 18th, that means that you are 18th best in the whole country. And how cool is that?
Mm.
It was just that sense of perspective. And he had so many of these wise words where I was just like, you know what? You're right. Being 18th best in the whole country is pretty darn cool. And, you know, it just has allowed me to really focus on enjoying it rather than thinking about what place I was going to finish.
And being so close to your dad and him supporting you through so much, it was particularly devastating then to lose him, right, to a brain tumor.
Yeah, it was like a real hard thing. And to think that he never got to see me win an Olympic medal was, you know, the most heartbreaking thing, because every day before he died, he was asking whether we had tickets for the Olympics. Do we have our seats yet? Are we close to the diving boards? Are we going to have a good view? And, you know, going into those Olympics in 2012, I felt like I had to really do it for us as a team. And it was something that we'd worked really hard for as an end goal. And, you know, I was really fortunate that some of my dad's ashes were buried at the bottom of the diving steps, so that every time before I went up onto the diving board, I was able to touch under the tiles where his ashes were to kind of feel him with me. And, you know, which was a huge comfort going through those Olympics.
That is remarkable. You say something in the book that I think is a great metaphor for life. You write, you cannot focus on the outcome. You can only focus on the process. What's the lesson there?
You know, there's so many times I've gone into competition and, you know, you see someone else performing well and you want to kind of outdo them and you want to win a medal. I want to win gold, or I want to win, you know, I want to be able to qualify for this competition or this final. And actually, if you're constantly thinking about what you want as the outcome, you're not actually being present and you're not staying in the moment. And I had to really focus hard on focusing on the process of what I needed to do in order to get there. Because you can't just go from A to B. There's so much that goes on between A and B in order to make the journey as smooth as possible.
Mm. I've got to ask you about your knitting. You took up knitting as a way to relax before a dive meet. There's a great picture of you at the Tokyo Games sitting with your knitting needles. You got a lot of attention for that. It was really cool.
I love knitting. I literally love knitting. And it was something I started at the beginning of lockdown because my coach wanted me to find something where I could rest and recover and not be doing too much. I'm always someone that's on the go. And it was my husband who said to me, lots of people in film sets knit squares just to pass the time and unwind and relax. So I was like, you know what, I'll give it a go. Why not? And then, you know, my personality is to throw myself into it as much as possible. And, you know, honestly, it became my superpower during the Olympics. You know, it was a COVID Olympic Games. There were no spectators. We weren't allowed outside of the village. We weren't allowed to socialize very much. There was a lot of spare time and a lot of time to think and worry about your competition. So honestly, it was my way of being able to escape everything, calm myself down. It was a form of mindfulness. And, you know, I still continue to do it every single day.
Mm. Well, you have quite a life now. You got married to Lance. You have a beautiful son. Coming full circle in everything that you've been through, how are you different today than when you started when you were, what, 9 years old?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think one thing that I would tell my younger self when I started is that there's no dream too big. Set your goals to an extremely high standard and just keep working towards them, because you never know, you might just get there. Working as hard as I have for these last 20 years in diving and working towards my dreams, I think, you know, if there's two words that would sum up my diving career, probably be resilience and perseverance. And those two things are things that have gotten me to, you know, finally win an Olympic gold medal in my fourth attempt.
Mm. Tom Daley's memoir is coming up for air. Tom Daley, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
President Biden is preparing for his first trip to South Korea on Friday. He'll meet the country's new president, who took office just last week. The summit comes as North Korea appears to be getting ready to test an intercontinental ballistic missile. North Korea is also in the midst of what looks like a big wave of COVID-19 cases, but so far that hasn't stopped the missile tests. And for the first time in 5 years, the country may be about to test a nuclear weapon. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
Deep in the mountains of North Korea, about 60 miles from the border with China, there's a village called Punggye-ri, and near that village is North Korea's main nuclear test site.
Imagine that you're next to a creek, and all around you are these very tall mountains.
Jeffrey Lewis is an arms control expert at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California.
To your north, there is a tunnel entrance, and inside that mountain, there is a network of tunnels where North Korea did 5 of its last 6 nuclear tests.
The other test was done in the same complex, but in a different tunnel. North Korea partially dismantled Punggye-ri in 2018. It declared a moratorium on nuclear testing and began a year-long period of summit diplomacy. This March, Lewis looked at satellite pictures and saw signs of construction, suggesting that North Korea could be planning to resume nuclear testing. One danger of underground nuclear tests is that radiation could leak out. But Lewis believes Punggye-ri is pretty solid.
There are several hundred meters of granite above those test tunnels, which is more than enough to contain even very large nuclear explosions.
There are, of course, riskier ways of testing atomic bombs than detonating them underground. Adam Mount, a fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, explains.
The major risk is that they mount a nuclear warhead on a ballistic missile, fire it over Japan into the Pacific, and detonate it above the surface of the water.
This year, North Korea has tested many kinds of missiles, long-range, short-range, submarine-launched, train-launched, hypersonic, and cruise missiles. Mount says all of these may carry nuclear warheads, which first need to be tested.
Depending which systems they want to make nuclear-capable, it may require them to develop a generation of new nuclear warheads for those systems.
North Korea needs to miniaturize the warheads, and to make its nuclear deterrent credible, Mount says, they need to prove the weapons really work.
Until Kim Jong-un is sure that the United States believes that he has a functional nuclear deterrent, he may have an incentive to continue to demonstrate that he does. Kim Jong-un has a very strong incentive to convince the U.S. president personally.
President Biden will meet with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol this Sunday in Seoul, and experts think that a nuke test this month is highly likely. This test would signal the end of a five-year-long testing moratorium. By scrapping the moratorium, Jeffrey Lewis says, Pyongyang will be clearing away a major obstacle to its nuclear ambitions.
When Kim Jong-un agreed to stop testing long-range missiles, and when he agreed to stop exploding nuclear weapons, that was a real constraint, not on his deterrent that he had at that time, but on his ability to build the deterrent that he is about to embark on.
With nuclear talks between the U.S. and North Korea stalled since 2019, the prospect of negotiating a new moratorium appears for now to be nowhere on the horizon. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
The possible reversal of the United States Supreme Court's landmark ruling Roe v. Wade is having a significant impact at the local level. Nine states, including Michigan, have abortion bans that were enacted before the Supreme Court ruling. And those bans could possibly be enforced again if Roe is overturned.
But yesterday, a judge in Michigan blocked the potential enforcement of its state law, which dates back to 1931. The judge sided with the reproductive health care provider Planned Parenthood, which brought the lawsuit against the state. The temporary injunction means that if the Supreme Court does eventually overturn its Roe v. Wade decision, Michigan's law would not take effect until Planned Parenthood's lawsuit is resolved. While the U.S. could be on the verge of restricting abortion laws abroad, in some traditionally conservative countries, it's a different story. Enid Muthoni is a chief program officer based in Geneva, Switzerland, for the Center for Reproductive Rights. That's a legal advocacy organization that supports abortion rights. Muthoni says the U.S. is at odds with a general move around the world towards more liberal abortion laws and policies.
In the last 25 years, over 60 countries have liberalized their laws. Right now, there's a couple of countries that still maintain total abortion bans in the world. Those countries have decreased and now are only about 23 countries across the world. Some of those are in Europe. We have Malta that is amongst those countries, and a couple of them also in Latin America. But generally to say, even in Latin America, Anthony, you'll remember, is where we are seeing the green wave, which has seen some of the most conservative countries like Argentina, like Colombia, actually moving to decriminalize abortion.
And what do you think explains that general trend? Because as you know, here in the United States, things seem to be moving in a very different direction. What explains this general trend to liberalize abortions across the globe?
The first thing we see is that one of the driver in the changes across the globe to have abortion less, become more, laws become more liberalized and to have abortion become more accessible is that more and more countries are actually beginning to view abortion as a health service, and advocates and actors in those countries are using legal advocacy, they are going to court, they're using human rights mechanisms to push their governments to recognize abortion as an essential health service. Unlike the US, where the discussion is really almost centered on politicizing women and girls and persons requiring abortion services, the conversation in most of the other parts of the world where we are seeing progress is that actually abortion is recognized as a fundamental right for women, girls, and people requiring this service.
All right. Well, you mentioned Latin America, and I wanted to ask you about that because, as you mentioned, we have seen significant changes in laws in Argentina and most recently Colombia, where the country's constitutional court legalized abortion during the first 24 weeks of pregnancy. I understand that your organization was among the groups that litigated that case.
Yes.
Tell me about that. I mean, tell me how the sort of tide turned in Colombia.
So Colombia, just a few years ago, around 2014, was one of the countries with the most restrictive abortion laws. And actors in that country, starting with the movement, which is a coalition of about 90 organizations and 134 advocates, started advocating to have, provisions that women and girls could access abortion services.
Hmm.
The movement really worked on changing the narrative in the community. Because one of the biggest challenge with abortion is that it is such a stigmatized word and it is such a stigmatized process that even having the community engage in that conversation is a difficult conversation. So by the movement fighting against stigma, by the movement actually talking about what they were calling social decriminalization, so having people start viewing abortion as a health service, as a human rights issue, changed the conversation. It made it possible for, even actors within even the religious movement, actors in the political movement, to start coalescing around this issue, not as a stigmatized issue, but as a health issue and a human rights issue.
It's really interesting. I'm thinking of Latin America. I'm thinking as well as looking over at Europe. Back in 2018, the Irish Parliament legalized abortion during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. And previously, Ireland had been one of the most restrictive, had one of the most restrictive abortion laws in Europe. So I'm struck by this. Ireland and Latin America, both parts of the world where abortion laws have become more liberal. Here in the U.S., the opposition to abortion is very much the result of religious views that all life is sacred. How is it that countries with strict Catholic influences, such as Ireland and parts of Latin America, have been able to convince people to support abortion rights despite having similar religious beliefs?
If we talk about Ireland, it's that actually even before the referendum that really made the change around abortion laws in Ireland, there had really already been like a start of a deep social change conversation in the country itself. And of course, there was also a sense that the influence of the church was diminishing in some of the areas where the conversation was happening. But I think what changed the tide in Ireland and just as much as in Colombia was really getting the conversation from the politicians and taking it to the people. So, for example, in Ireland, one of the things that the movement did was to engage, the services of social communicators who were able to assist the movement to frame the conversations in a language that a common person in Ireland could identify with. So removing it from the moralistic, stigmatized, protectionist conversation that is currently happening and political conversation that is currently happening in the U.S. to really have people talking about seeing that the people who need these services are, the woman that is next to you, it's the girl that you know. And so the changing of the narrative and taking away the narrative from the politicians to the people themselves was one of the biggest turning points in Ireland.
I see. Finally, Enid, if Roe versus Wade is overturned here in the United States, what effect does that have? What message does that send out across the world? And does it influence policies in other countries?
I would say, abortion is a very emotive issue. Mm-hmm. And the biggest danger, I think, why this is also a big concern to everyone, not just in the U.S. alone, and why it's maybe very fraught and protracted, is that what the U.S. does at the end of the day becomes a precursor to what many other restrictive governments might actually do across the world.
Mm-hmm.
Although just to mention as well that, if Roe does get overturned, the U.S. actually becomes an extreme outlier and is going to join countries like El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Poland in the total list of countries that have rolled back abortion rights since 1994. And also the impact of these bans that are likely to happen once, you know, if Roe goes down, the impact on the most vulnerable groups in the U.S., including people of color and, you know, poor people, really is going to be immense. Of course, in every country, it's a very fraught conversation. Really, the one for the U.S., I think it's the magnitude.
Yeah.
And also it's the extent to which a country can really regress within such a short period from where it was having a constitutional guarantee to access to abortion.
All right. Well, that's Enid Muthoni. She's program officer at the Center for Reproductive Rights. It's a global advocacy organization that supports abortion rights. She was speaking to us from Geneva. Enid Muthoni, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
The surrender of Ukrainian soldiers in Mariupol leaves the port city in Russian hands. It's a victory for invading Russian forces who have failed to capture territory elsewhere in Ukraine. And it comes after Ukrainian soldiers pushed Russians out of areas around Kharkiv. So what is the state of play for Russian and Ukrainian forces nearly 3 months into the war? Let's ask Dmitry Gornberg. He's a senior research scientist at the CNA, a nonprofit security think tank. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Russia currently controls a swath of land in the east and the south of Ukraine. Ukrainian forces have launched a successful counteroffensive around Kharkiv. Tell us how much land Russia currently controls, and does Ukraine have a strategy to take it back?
Well, it's if you look at it as a whole, you know, compared to the whole of Ukraine, it's like 10 or 15% of the territory. But it's strategically significant because it cuts off a large part of Ukraine's access to the sea. As for plans for retaking the territory, it's hard to know at the moment. There's certainly been suggestions that Ukraine would launch a major counteroffensive in the summer once it has more of the new military equipment it's been getting from the West. At the same time, the Russian forces are digging in certain places. So it's hard to know whether how successful that such an offensive would be or whether it would end up being kind of a long-term stalemate.
So talk more about the strategic significance of what happened in Mariupol. And Russia seems to have finally ended this standoff. 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers have surrendered. This was a win for Russia, no?
Well, it's a public relations win for sure, because now they can claim to hold the entire southern corridor. It's maybe less of a strategic win because the Mariupol forces have kind of fulfilled their mission of keeping Russian forces away from the big fight to the north for several weeks while that offensive was going on. And now it's pretty much bogged down, so that is no longer as relevant.
Mm. Ukraine's defense minister has repeated that Ukraine is bracing for a drawn-out war. And yet a retired Russian colonel recently went on TV and surprised many Russians when he admitted that Russia's resources are, quote, limited politically and militarily. What did you make of those comments?
Well, the colonel, Khodorionok, he has been on the record in the past as being somewhat cautious about Russian capabilities. He did that before the war even started. So the fact that he was on TV suggests that the Russians are starting to shift the public towards a recognition that this may not all be so rosy for them.
And on the other hand, Ukrainian President Zelensky said Russia is attempting to compensate for what he called their military failures in the east of the country by launching cruise missile strikes on other parts of Ukraine. Does that seem to be the working strategy, this sort of scorched earth policy?
I think that there's an element of Russian policy that is just to punish Ukraine at this point for Russia's own failures by attacking infrastructure in the west. It kind of holds the whole country hostage in a way, without much military significance for many of these strikes. Similarly, the blockade of exports along the Black Sea is hurting Ukraine economically. So I think that's another way of punishing the country.
How much of a difference is it making on the ground in Ukraine that the U.S. and others continue to pour money and weapons and support into Ukraine?
Oh, I think it's critical because I don't think that Ukraine could sustain the fight without new infusions of equipment. They're just in terms of, for example, ammunition. They're beginning to run out of the older munitions. They've been using a lot of ammunition in this fight, and it's going to be harder and harder to replace the Soviet ammunition. So having Western weapons that can be resupplied with Western munitions is critical.
Mm. And hanging over this conflict, Dmitry, is the fact that Russia has nuclear weapons and continues here and there to threaten to use them. Do you think recent developments in this war have made it less likely or more likely that at some point Putin could use them?
I think it's pretty unlikely that nuclear weapons would be used in this kind of scenario. The one potential path that where it could come down to that is if Russia does follow through on its stated plan to annex some of the territories they have occupied, and then there is a successful counteroffensive where Ukraine is retaking those territories, because then, from the Russian point of view, Ukraine is attacking Russian territory, and that, within their doctrine, is a reason to use nuclear weapons. But I think a lot of what we've been seeing on the nuclear front is rhetoric aimed at making sure that the West doesn't get directly involved in the fight, rather than any kind of messaging that they would actually use them.
That's Dmitry Gorenberg, senior research scientist at CNA. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Here and Now.